Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome. I'm Benjamin De La Peña. I serve as the Director of Community and National Strategy at the Knight Foundation, which is headquartered in Miami. And if you ask me what Miami is like, I will say it has very good weather. So welcome to this panel. We have some of you already have their bios, but I will walk you through their bios shortly as I introduce them. Who here remembers what the internet was like in 1990? Right. Tell me, what was the internet like in 1990? You did. It was all, what were the modes back then? You didn't have the World Wide Web. In 1990, Tim Berners-Lee wrote a paper called World Wide Web, No Spaces Between World Wide Web, a proposal for a hypertext software at CERN. And in that same year, he tested this thing, and it was a way to find out all of the information they had in CERN. That was 25 years ago. And that's how much things can change in 25 years, right? I'm sure you have your phones, and I'm sure you check your Facebook every now and then if you're above 40. If you're below 30, you're probably checking Snapchat and deleting furiously. So the technology shift in those 25 years has been amazing. The year that they released, that RPA released, the third 25-year plan, which was 1996, right? They had just tested GSM and were releasing GSM. If you guys remember that funny sound that GSM does whenever you were near a speaker and you had a GSM phone, they were starting to test that. And our panelists were all in different stages of their career. Three of them were just coming out of high school, right? 18 and 17 years old. Noel Hidalgo was voted the most organized person in his high school because he had an Apple Newton, right? He had an Apple Newton, and I wonder if he still has it. That's probably a collector's item. And Nick, who's all into technology, was just chilling out, enjoying Brooklyn. Maya was already working. We're in the same generation. We won't tell you what generation that is. Working already in the attorney's U.S. attorney's office, and doing prosecution. So, meanwhile, in New York and in the U.S., the most famous, the best-selling toy was Buzz Lightyear, right, which would soon be eclipsed by Tickle Me Elmo. Now, the younger ones here, did you have a Tickle Me Elmo in 1996? Raise your hand if you did. Right, you're not going to admit it. I'm sure you did. That was an irritating toy. Right. So what we're going to do today is talk about the digital divide as it is. And Mandu, who is a planner and works with the Regional Planning Association, and she's written the report on the future of work and is working on this section of the fourth 25-year plan on technology and the digital divide. Is going to walk us through the divide and what its implications are. But let's bear in mind the kind of differences, the changes that could happen within 25 years that we would have not imagined 25 years ago. My panelists, again, I've introduced them briefly to all of you. Mandu Sen is with the Regional Planning Association. She'll start us off with a brief presentation. Noel Hidalgo is an Eagle Scout, and don't you forget it, right? Which means he gets things done. He is the president or CEO? What's the title of executive director of Beta NYC, which is the largest meetup in the country and maybe in the world on open data.
I think the government. Taiwanese are a little bit larger than us.
The Taiwanese, it's a very small island.
But they have so many more people that are engaged in this.
There you go. So I've known him for about a decade now, and I've known him around civic tech and civic hacking circle. White hat, but definitely a white hat. Nick Grossman is the general manager of, or is it managing director? General manager of Union Square Ventures, venture capitalist. It's based here in New York. They incubate and they invest in startups. He used to be with Open Plans New York. That's when we first met, again, over a decade ago, working on open data and helping the MTA do their bus time system. So before Nick came around and Open Plans, you didn't know when the bus was coming. Nowadays, maybe you still don't know when the bus is coming. But they've had some changes. And Maya Wiley was working on civil rights since she was 3 years old. Her father was a big figure in civil rights, and she remembers wanting to be a judge because people would meet, and there were these women on welfare that would meet in their household, and they were all being oppressed by this judge who had so many biases. And she thought, being a judge, that would be a good thing. And so she took up law, and now she is the counsel to the mayor here at New York City, handling particularly technology. And so we will hear from her on what the city is planning to do to bridge this digital divide. And with that, may I pass you on to Mandu.
Thank you very much. So thank you very much for this introduction, and everyone for being here today. This reminder of what things were like in 1996 is a great starting point for me, because the first thing I wanted to say is really broadband, and not technology specifically, but broadband specifically is really a new area for planners. And, you know, if you think about transportation, you know, there are entire institutions, there's data, there are tools to sort of start planning and sort of like designing systems and identifying who does what. When it comes to, you know, broadband, you know, that doesn't exist yet. The knowledge, the infrastructure, the institutions do not exist. So we're really particularly eager to share our ideas about reversing the digital divide as part of the fourth plan as early as possible with everyone in the room and, of course, our panel here today. So thank you. We really appreciate it. You know, what we hope to convince you of today is sort of like really three things. First of all, that the digital divide is a real problem. It really threatens the region, and that we need to take it really seriously, and there's an urgency in addressing it. Second of all, that a big part of that is seeing government take a much bigger role in broadband specifically and certain technological issues more generally in order to do that. And thirdly, that we really think that there should be some public investment in broadband infrastructure. So, you know, that's what we're sort of going to start it with today. And, you know, just a few definitions. Digital divide can mean different things to different people. What we're talking about today is two pieces. It's the broadband infrastructure, so having access to the internet, and then there are digital skills. I'm going to focus more about the infrastructure simply because we're urban planners and that's, you know, what we deal with, but digital skills are a critical piece of it, and it's going to be, you know, part of what the panel discusses later on. So, you know, why are we talking about it? You know, I think the way we think about it, you know, as we were studying, you know, doing our sort of major survey of the New York metropolitan region, and we saw huge increases in inequality over the last 25 years, in many ways exceeding those that you've seen in the United States overall. So we sort of like identified three ways. So first of all, the digital divide could actually increase inequality even more. The digital divide could actually limit our competitiveness. New York region has always stood out as you know, as we think about it, the number one metropolitan region in the world. And the digital divide could really limit that. And finally, there's climate change and more generally our vulnerability to disasters. And that's another risk that we need to be thinking about. Oops, sorry. Our recommendations are preliminary. And just in a nutshell, what you know, the framework we're thinking about, there are really two pieces. First of all, and this might sound really obvious, but it just doesn't exist yet, we really need more local government functions dedicated to broadband, and that they also need to be focused on cross-municipal or regional coordination. Again, this might sound like you know something that you expect that already exists, but it really doesn't. You know, we have Maya Wiley here today, who's sort of really one of the leaders here in the United States on these issues, but this is not true if you go to any of the other 700-plus municipalities across the region. Our second recommendation is that there's a real opportunity to make public investments in infrastructure as part of, you know, the vision we have for the fourth regional plan across the region, in tandem with sort of the development we hope and expect to see throughout the region. And we can do it in such a way that actually increases opportunity for the diverse communities that we have here across the region. So, you know, most of you, you know, we've all lived it and experienced this, but should probably spend some time talking about it. Where are we today? You know, so technology has already transformed the way most of us live. Most of us, not all of us, by the way, but just most of us, routinely use the internet, use email. You know, we're so used to it, we take it for granted. Online shopping has already transformed the physical environment we live in. You know, most of us use smartphones to get various services. You know, for those of us at RPA who had to be here at 6 a.m. this morning, having an on-demand car service was extremely helpful. you know, and then there's what's coming down the pipeline that we're pretty sure is happening. When and how exactly, we don't know, but it's definitely coming. You know, many aspects of health services are becoming virtual. That's going to be a big change. You know, things like being able to control appliances remotely. It's already, many people are able to do it. That's going to happen more and more. We're going to see more and more sensors in our environment, sort of helping us control both our health, safety, etc. Then there are uses that we're sort of beginning to imagine, but we don't entirely understand their implications yet. So naturally, it's a little hard to describe them, but just two things to think about. Just autonomous cars. You know, we need a really robust broadband infrastructure to sort of enable this near instantaneous movement of information that would enable us to have these kind of giant fleets of autonomous cars that some of us are envisioning. If you're thinking about things like drones, some people theorize that if you want to actually have drones effectively and use them in a way that's good and beneficial, you'd have to have the physical infrastructure in place again to sort of like enable instantaneous communications. And, you know, we may or may not be, and all of these things are kind of, could be transformative in good and bad ways. So, you know, there are various dangers to this, but I think the danger we really want to focus, the risk we really want to think about today is that, you know, it's entirely possible and possibly and perhaps probable if we continue doing what we're doing today, that not everyone will share these advantages. Today, more than 1 in 5 households in the region lacks access to broadband. As some of you know, there are many definitions of broadband. We're using a very, very generous definition. And even so, we're talking about 20% of the region of the households who do not have access to broadband at home. We do slightly better than the rest of the United States, but not as well as, say, San Francisco in that regard. This is based on analysis from the really indispensable Open Technology Institute. They went and looked at the cost of the broadband at $40 a month. What can you get in different cities? And all of these cities are cities that we, you know, in the New York region, routinely think of as our competitors, as our peers, as you know, as, again, we think that we're number one. But, you know, for $40, the speed you get in New York is like you could get 60 times faster speed in Paris and Hong Kong compared to New York. And even San Francisco does a lot better than us in that respect. And, you know, 60 times, think about it. Is that a, you know, difference that you'd find tolerable when it came to energy costs or transportation costs? Imagine that your Metro card costs 60 times more than it costs in Paris. Then there's, you know, the heart of the digital divide. So 20% of households in the region are without broadband, but if you look at households that are poor or low income, it's above 40%. So, you know, when people talk about the homework gap, this is what they're talking about. Children who are maybe more likely to go to a public school that's not as well performing, and then they go home and there's a good chance that they can't access the internet and they can't do homework. And this can have really long-term impacts on inequality. So this is an analysis that sort of tries to assess how many jobs are at high risk of automation. And typically, generally speaking, high school people with education levels who have completed high school or less are far more likely to have jobs that are at high risk of automation than people, say, with a master's degree. And this is what we're talking about when we're saying that the digital divide could potentially even increase inequality, as if it's not bad enough today. Then, again, mentioned health services. We're projecting that we might see as much as a doubling of the number of seniors in the region. If we imagine these seniors wanting to work from home after the age of 65 or needing increased access to health services via the internet, again, they need broadband access. This is another area where digital divide could pair. Digital services could play, you know, either a good or a negative role. Then there's climate change. I think anyone who is here around Sandy seen this image of people sort of standing trying to either get reception on their phones, or in this case, this is an impromptu email checking station in Jersey City a day after Sandy. This is, of course, we've all seen that, and this is pretty, you know, something that we can expect to see again if we don't make some big changes in how we treat broadband. And really, you know, why are we here where we are? So, you know, what works is really a big result of how our broadband system is designed. The primary driver behind much of our broadband infrastructure are market forces. So they've definitely succeeded in providing critical capital, made certain investments possible. They also left many people behind. This is why typically, you know, when it comes to infrastructure utilities, you either have a public sector that's owning and making the investments in operating infrastructure, or you have private utilities that are regulated pretty strictly. In broadband, you have neither system, really. So this is where we are. The result is a system that is incredibly fragmented, different providers, different infrastructure owners. You know, this means also that it's hard to access the infrastructure itself. So we're not just talking about end users like low-income households. We're talking about potential third-party providers who have a hard time accessing the infrastructure. And this is, by the way, why resiliency is such a challenge. Nobody really knows what's going on there on a systematic level. While you could sort of like test the transportation system and figure out what's going on and what are risks, it's really a lot harder to do that as a system to what is in effect our regional broadband system. And finally, there are huge gaps in capacity between different governments in the region, between New York City and, again, the other 700-plus municipalities across the region in terms of even addressing this issue. Like I said before, it's not an issue where there's, you know, the civic sector, then the public sector have a lot of expertise, don't even necessarily know where to start talking about these things. And that's a major reason why we are where we are. So going back to our recommendations, so there are two parts to it. The first is increasing capacity amongst government, to understand what's happening in broadband, to cooperate. It doesn't make sense for, say, every single municipality in New York State to have to sign its own franchise agreement. And even if you're not making, say, investments, direct investments in infrastructure, even if the public sector is not making those kinds of investments, we need more expertise in government to deal with things like resiliency, to deal with things like being better negotiators if you're signing a franchise agreement. And the next piece that's, you know, I think the real opportunity of the fourth regional plan is making public investments in infrastructure and digital skills, specifically in low-income communities, and really leveraging redevelopment as a potential opportunity and not something that increases inequality. This is a map of the share of households without broadband in 2014, and as you can see, sort of there are definitely clear concentrations of places where there are, you know, households without access to broadband. They're also highly correlated with areas of low income. This is another way of looking at it. This is a chart that shows different municipalities of the region by share of households without broadband. And just one example, New Haven has 2.5 times more households without broadband than Stamford, that's just a few stops down the metro line. Now, many of these places are places where we think have enormous capacity for growth. And in fact, you know, Tom Wright in the morning talked about how we think that the right kind of growth, the equitable, sustainable growth, could, you know, growth that goes works where communities work together to, you know, redevelop where they live, can really sort of be a potential boon for equality, increase access to jobs, increase access to transportation, increase, you know, community amenities. We think that this is an opportunity to sort of also reimagine broadband development. So, you know, one model we've seen across the United States is building municipal broadband networks. There are hundreds of examples of, across the United States of successful municipal networks, which is basically a very simple idea. Municipality invests in its own broadband infrastructure. They're often public-private partnerships. Not all of them are successful, but a lot of them are. This is Cedar Falls, Iowa. Paris, that example of a place that has 1,000 megabytes for $40 is also a municipal broadband network, by the way. The city invested in building the infrastructure, and a private operator provides the services. Then there's public Wi-Fi. Here, too, I think we need to start thinking about it as this, you know, basic amenity. First of all, it's the Internet of Last Resort. If we're talking about inequality, it's at least one way to access the Internet. It's not sufficient for most people's needs, but it's important. Secondly, you know, if you want to opt out, then it's important, if you want to opt out of an over-connected environment, having public free Wi-Fi is actually important so that you have the option to opt in. This is Link NYC. New York City is really a national, if not international, leader in providing public Wi-Fi. Looking forward to hear what you have to say about it. And this is, again, something that we should make standard across the region. Now, certain things need to happen to make the most of these kinds of physical investments. Again, some of these things, you think they're happening already, but they're not. In reality, that's not how it works. We need to have synchronized planning across users and municipalities. Right now, it's entirely possible, in fact, probable, that you might have a fiber optic cable connecting a business, but not the church next door. Typically, broadband infrastructure does not necessarily take into account zoning. It doesn't take, you know, the breaks in the infrastructure, they're not in the right places. Things like that, things that should be happening are not necessarily happening. There are various things we can do around streamlining access to public infrastructure like poles and ducts that can simplify infrastructure deployment. And of course, any kind of investment is going to be costly. One commonly used metric is $1,500 per home to connect to a fiber optic. Although this varies a lot, it's probably a lot more in a place like Manhattan. By and large, first of all, this is infrastructure, and we typically invest in infrastructure. Secondly, there are good chances that we can actually get a return on investment over time. Successful municipal broadband examples use revenue bonds. There are a lot of good examples of public-private partnerships. We use that term a lot, but really with broadband, you do see a lot of successful examples. And finally, and this is, you know, it's, I'm saying less about it than other issues, but definitely not the least, we need to think about how we incorporate digital skills development into any kind of infrastructure investment we make. When we go and, say, invest in parks, today we usually think about the programming, even though it's, you know, not necessarily the bread and butter of urban planners. So we need to think about how do we work together with schools, with workforce development opportunities, et cetera, to sort of both invest in infrastructure and invest in digital skills. This is it. Thank you very much for listening. I look forward to hearing from all of you about your thoughts and some of the ideas we put forth. And thanks for everyone in the room. And please feel free to reach out to me afterwards. We'd love to hear from you. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Mandy. And so what we'll do is we'll discuss with the panelists for about 20 or so minutes, and we'll open it up for Q&A. So Mandu stressed the whole risk that this poses to the region. And again, I go back to the third plan. The title was A Region at Risk. And it was coming out of a decade of a downturn, a significant downturn. There were double-digit drops in the value of property and housing across the region. The next decade, there were triple-digit growths in the value of 124% of properties and rent across the region. So then 1996 was this fulcrum. It looked like everything was going to go down, and suddenly it went up, and we had even wider disparities. So I'm going to go down and ask each of our panelists to give us their reaction to this and what struck out from Mandu's presentation and what you think we should be paying attention to as we roll this out. I'm also conscious, and I'm going to start with Maya, is that the dynamics of this thing is that governments and infrastructure tend to move slowly. Right, you make an investment and it takes about maybe 5 years to get that built. if it's the Second Avenue subway, half a century. And then you roll it out, and then it'll be running. But that's not how technology is moving. When bus time planning was, when you guys were building bus time planning, the problem that the MTA had was they would make these big contracts and take 3 years to roll out, and by the time you were done, it was obsolete. Right? Versus technology, which is then moving very, very fast. So I'll frame it with that, but then I'll start first with Ms. Wiley, Maya. Tell us, you know, what struck you with that, and if you want to tell us a bit of how you think the administration, I don't want to make you the administration spokesman, but maybe you will be, to tell us, what you're doing.
Well, thank you, and I really appreciated Mandu's presentation because I think she hit on so many salient and critically important points, and we are a region at risk if we don't have equitable broadband access. But I kind of want to both pull it back and pan out a little bit from what Mandu said, and I'm in complete agreement. The pulling back is to say that this is also a highly racialized divide. It is not just an income divide. And the reason that's important is because if we're really going to talk about universal broadband access, particularly in a region that is highly diverse, I mean, remember that 2/3 of New Yorkers are not white, and that literally 36% of our population was not born in the United States. We have 800 languages. That a lot of what we're talking about when we talk about that exclusion is actually also not only racialized, but also racialized. And that the way we got to the design that Mandu talked about was really that we started building broadband infrastructure on top of an already inequitable telephone system. So that actually civil rights was when I was in the U.S. Attorney's Office, when the Telecommunications Act of 1996 was being debated, actually civil rights groups, including the NAACP, including La Raza, were already working on the fact that the telephone system itself had actually redlined communities of color, and that everyone understood the infrastructure was going to follow a lot of that proprietary infrastructure that was telephone lines to go to a more advanced form of technology that was going to get us to broadband. So we're literally, without necessarily having racial intent to discriminate, because we are building on top of a discriminatory infrastructure, we are reinforcing over and over again that discrimination that happened decades before. And I think that is really important when we also talk about then what the solutions are. So that's my pulling back. My panning out from that is to say a couple of things. So the technology itself, as we know, is also racialized in who uses what and how. So as we know, far more blacks and Latinos are going to rely on their mobile phones. They do have smartphones. We're much more likely. I got two. It's not a happy thing, but I do. But we actually are more likely to rely on our mobile phones for our broadband access. So we don't have home-based broadband, but we have broadband, right? But it's pay-as-you-go often, which is why these wireless hotspots matter so much in Link NYC. But it also means that how we think about bridging that divide also has to recognize the technology that people are using, and that we are not all using the same technologies all the time, or that some of us are limited to certain technologies, right? And that makes some of the kinds of interventions we have to think about as local government, as advocates, as community-based groups across the board, we have to think about that as well when we want to bridge the divide. And if we take that one step further, and it seems fortuitous to sit next to someone from Fred Wilson's shop on this, because Fred Wilson has been talking about how artificial intelligence is actually going to be potentially the next leap, right, over what has been essentially a network system of development. And I think one of the things we have to recognize is we're asking cities to actually catch up to the early 2000s when the technology is about to create a paradigmatic shift. And a paradigmatic shift for the economy that's going to take the same communities we're talking about who are disconnected and actually displace them even from low-wage jobs. So if we really want to talk about a region in crisis, it's actually it's not even a critique, my addition to what Mandu said is it's a much bigger crisis than she even shared. And that it's our challenge to both think about how we're doing that infrastructure build out and connection, but in recognizing that the whole paradigm is changing and we don't even know how yet.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
So my takeaway from you, which is surprising, is that the structure, the infrastructure of the city is built on discrimination, which is news to everyone,
world.
Right? The way we...
It's true of many things.
Cut infrastructure through the city. But you're pointing out something, too, that these shifts, I can imagine people going through digital training and learning how to code. And I know that for, I think, the last 2 years now, every now and then, Silicon Valley will be secretly consumed by this rumor that either Facebook or Apple or Google have developed the algorithms that code. And the way you write code is actually, these days, is that you frame a problem, and then you just try to write the code to solve that problem, whatever works well. So the coders in Silicon Valley, some of the most highly paid people in the country, are worried about losing their jobs because someone will write an AI that can do their work. So I think that's another risk that we have to think about. Nick?
Yeah, I'm glad you took it to jobs and automation, because that's a whole nother level. And the idea that infrastructure is and can be discriminatory historically. If you look at the road network, yeah. I mean, that was a discriminatory infrastructure as well. And that's, I think, an important lens. I'll say first, I think it's really important that the RPA and this community is looking at this issue in the context of the fourth plan. I've been involved in these discussions for a while, and you know, this conversation has been about jobs and housing and roads for a long time. And I think it's my, you know, the horse is dead, but it's not still not dead yet, is that, you know, broadband is the new infrastructure, and digital is how the economy is going to get shaped, and the investment in infrastructure that the region makes around here is going to have a huge impact on the way people live and the way the city works, and more than we can even know. So kudos for, you know, trying to bring this into the conversation. I know it's not a natural fit. At USV, we're investors at the applications layer of the internet, so social networks and e-commerce platforms and marketplaces and developer tools. And so our self-interest has always been, let's make sure broadband access is everywhere, because then there will be more people to use the apps. We spend a lot of time focusing on public policy and regulatory issues, and have gotten involved in a lot of the politics of broadband at the FCC and so on. And more recently, we've also started making some investments in alternative broadband access plays. And that's where I want to focus a little bit in the context here, is that, you know, so if there's a sort of legacy of infrastructure that in the phone system that has certain characteristics, I think there's a legacy mindset about broadband access, which is, you know, big cable companies come in, lay cable, give us integrated services. We have one or two options. Maybe we get broadband from on our mobile phones. That's just kind of how it works. I think what's so interesting, looking at all the experiments that are happening across the U.S. right now and other places, that there are other models and other ways that cities can support broadband access and build their own infrastructure. So, and I think that experimentation is really, really important. You know, Link NYC is an incredible example of building infrastructure to give Wi-Fi. That's one thing. Another model that's emerging is where the city lays the dark fiber. There's no electronics on it. There's no light running through it, but they own the fibers. And then others will come in and light them up. So Google is partnering with the city of Huntsville, Alabama right now to bring Google Fiber there. But instead of Google building all the infrastructure from the bottom up, which is what they did in the first couple of cities, the city of Huntsville is building the dark fiber. Google's lighting it up, and it's non-exclusive. So any other people can come in and light it up. And what's so great about that model is that it has the potential to offer true competition at the services layer that will, you know, ideally bring costs down and reduce the amount of infrastructure that you need to invest in at the bottom. And so aside from experimentation, I think the other, and identifying these new models and ways that cities can invest, and another issue which was mentioned but is also often overlooked is resiliency. So if you think about what happened in New York during Sandy after 9/11, you know, when you're broadband is reliant on centralized providers like a Verizon. When they go out, everybody's in the dark. And that doesn't have to be that way. There are wireless technologies like mesh networking where you can have phones talking directly to other phones. And you can build networks that way. Those are networks that don't go down and sort of model the original design on the of the internet, which was a network that can survive attacks. So I think it's important to think about resiliency and the role that cities can play in encouraging resilient networks, public networks and resilient networks. We're investors in a company called Venium, which builds technology for vehicle-based mesh networking. So you put the box on all the buses ride around the city, boom, you have a citywide mesh network connecting all the buses. There's a lot of activity of local groups building their own little Wi-Fi networks and mesh networks, and I think cities should really encourage that. So those are just some initial thoughts. I think this is, just really, really important discussion, and I'm glad to be having it.
So I like what you're pointing out, that there could be major technology shifts, too, that will happen, which Maya also picked up, that when you look at broadband, we tend to look at the fiber, but there's a lot going on the wireless, and maybe lot more could go on. And again, I go back to this long-range thing. You mentioned 9/11 and Sandy. If I remember, after 9/11, buildings were told, put your power units on the basement. This is safer that way. And then Sandy came, and Lower Manhattan was out of power. Noel, tell us about what your thoughts are. Well, by the way, Noel is not texting. He's taking digital notes because he's been doing that since he was on a Newton.
Thanks for reminding that.
It's been he really is. I can see that.
Yeah, 20 years of taking notes on Apple devices. I am maybe the... I don't know. Maybe a nerd, maybe not a nerd.
Definitely
so,
a nerd.
I think the three of us, it's an honor to be up here. I'm totally impressed with the everybody else who's on the panel because I feel like I'm not worthy. It's a Wayne World moment. I'm here to kind of represent about some of the social dynamics that are going on within the digital divide. What I'm seeing within this ecosystem is that ultimately it's a conversation of that we have granted power to other organizations or individuals, corporations, and now we need to figure out a way to kind of retain that ownership or gather that ownership back. And so where is the commons within this ecosystem? And part of that commons is understanding what's going on within these black boxes, what's going on within this technology. And so what we've been focused on at Beta NYC is getting the technology community, the people who actually understand what goes on within those black boxes and goes between the different pipes, and socializing those problems, particularly around civic technology and open data, and exposing where do we need to teach the next generation and kind of finding that gap and then building platforms to cross that gap. And I would say that we have a huge problem around, and around educating government leaders, and I will say those that are elected, those that are not elected, and those that are volunteer, and trying to figure out like what is the value of data and what is the value of technology. If you've, how many of you have ever gone to a community board or a school board meeting and hear them talk about data? How many have heard them talk about data? Right. Not too many of them ever go around and talk about data, but yet they're really passionate about solving the problems in their community. When I think about the higher level issues, I like to look at what Detroit has done around there's a Detroit Digital Justice Coalition where they have four main values, and that's access, participation, common ownership, and healthy communities, which I think at the highest level, when we're talking about bridging the digital divide, that's exactly what we're trying to do. We're trying to build those platforms for access. We want to bring as many people on board and develop common ownership and ultimately have a thriving, resilient communities through that are healthy. Now, let's see. Where do we want to go with the conversation next? Is something that I really don't know where we're going, other than I see things like Link NYC and I get scared for the fact that I know that there's a lot of good intention that's going into building these infrastructure, but I also know that it's creating a paradigm around handing off all of our information to an institution that wants to sell us better ads. And ultimately, I'm wondering, when we are trying to cross the digital divide, what are we actually trying to cross toward? Is it around building better ads, or is it fundamentally around building stronger and smarter communities where we can actually link arms and be more resilient? So
that's a great point to land on, and I'm going to pursue that. I'm going to pursue another thing, too, that you just said about, I'll put up in an end, we'll go back. But I want to ask two things. You framed that maybe we should be talking in terms of principles and what this needs to be. And I'm going to put a pin on that. I want to go back to it. But going through the panel, and Mandu joined us too, is what are the soft points where we think we can insert something that would really help bridge the digital divide? And what Noel was saying, as we tend to do because we don't have big plans on these things, is, well, the quickest way to do it is hand it off to someone, the private sector, to say, you roll it out, we'll get the contract, we get the thing out there, and then, boom, you've got the signal out there. And with no clear guides of what are we trying to achieve, apart from maybe replacing all the telephone booths that we used to have, which was really good real estate. What are the soft points in the system that you think we can insert, Maya particularly, so that we can start thinking about it differently and bridging that divide?
So I want to challenge the premise that Link NYC is not a challenge to that divide. And the reason I want to do that is I certainly, first of all, I share all the principles that Noel stated, and I feel confident saying we do as an administration, which is why we're creating free wireless corridors that are publicly funded to 21,000 public housing residents. We're creating 6 wireless corridors in Sandy-impacted communities. We are trying to connect to what's happening in local communities and how that's being done. So in Red Hook Houses, where Red Hook Initiative had digital stewards, which are young people from the housing development actually learning how to build the mesh network, and it's used really as a community content bulletin board. So it's actually a civic engagement end game, not an infrastructure end game. And I think we all see it as the end game is not the infrastructure. And when you see some of our infrastructure plays, if you think we're doing it only for the infrastructure, then I think you're misunderstanding like what we're actually trying to do. And the reason I want to challenge on Link NYC is, let me say it this way. So first of all, it is you can challenge whether or not as a country we should have a system that requires public-private partnership in order to build infrastructure. That's a legitimate debate, and if I could dial us back several decades, I would probably push for that, right? But since we haven't and we didn't, and this is the world we're in, and we can't, in my view, it will be at the expense of excluded communities to try to spend several more decades trying to get back there rather than doing what we can do now. The difference between Link NYC, that Link NYC is a ubiquity model. And I think that's a fundamental difference. Like if you take a Verizon, its business model is not based on ubiquity. If you take a Link NYC model, the business model is built on ubiquity. That is a public-private partnership that already starts with a different set of principles than how the infrastructure traditionally has been built. I think Noel's actually absolutely right that the questions are, well, what happens with that data? That's a legitimate question. One of the things that we did in negotiating was ensure the data couldn't be sold. Yes, it can be used for ads. That's true, because that's the revenue base for creating that. But what we did was the first contract that the city has had in giving people access to our streets and our street furniture, which actually enables us to get a guaranteed income. We are limited by the Telecommunications Act of 1996 to a 5% fee from Verizon and Cablevision and Time Warner Cable. On this franchise, because it doesn't fall within those provisions, we can get whatever we want, right? And we actually had a company, we got a $250 million guaranteed minimum payment. That is collectively what we got from all our cable providers in the city collectively over a 10-year period. That's a game changer because that's the revenue, frankly. That was the first down payment on getting public housing residents the wireless access that we're giving them, because to all the points about planning, you can't plan and get it done in the absence of the dollars. And the federal government is not giving them to us. So the only thing we can do as a practical matter is leverage the way we can drive revenue, but to drive it in a way where the principles are ubiquity, equity, because we ensured that it would get to every single borough, that it couldn't be concentrated in Manhattan, that it we have transparency and a deployment plan that requires equity, and that the revenue play actually helps us get to more of these public commons, publicly owned, community-controlled networks.
Nick?
I think there's going to be this question of values every time you get at how do you cross the divide. And an interesting example from recently that's not at the city level but at the national level was Facebook trying to bring free mobile internet to India through this program called Free Basics. And
it got shut down.
Right. So the model there was we'll partner with carriers, we'll sponsor everybody's data plans, but all the traffic's going to run through our servers, so we're going to see it all, and we're going to call the shots on who can be included and who can't be included. And that was very contentious because their argument was, well, hey, we're bringing internet to people who had nothing. Isn't something better than nothing? And the counterargument was, well, come on, that's not really the internet. And this is a control play, and that's not good enough. And I think that, and ultimately, there was a huge backlash, and the program got shut down, and Facebook is recalibrating, and maybe they'll figure out a way to tune that program in a way that works. But that tension of balancing ubiquity and accessibility with some other set of values is, I think, inherent here when you're going for a ubiquity model versus a market-based model. And to look at other cities, you know, Chattanooga was one of the first cities in the U.S. that did municipally owned broadband. They own the fibers and they run the service on top of it. And I don't know the full layout of it, but there's an area downtown where it's deployed. My understanding is that that's not a ubiquity model, and it can't be because people are paying for it, and that's where it goes.
And they're paying $26 a month on average, which if you're a public housing resident, is actually out of reach.
Right.
So I guess all that is to say, these are tough problems, and they come up every time. They're going to keep coming up as every city in every country deals with this question about how to bring access to people. And I don't think it's black and white. Clearly, I think I agree that the Facebook program was over the line. And the explanation you just gave about how you balance that in Lincoln, NYC makes a lot of sense. But every city is different. Every city is going to be different. Every case study is going to be different.
So you all the two of you pointed to some frame of the decision makers understanding this. From Maya, it was the decision makers understanding that we need the money. And if we take it from Peter,
we need the free service and we need the money.
And the money.
We get both.
Right.
That's
and
good.
And then you can then pay for the public housing connection and then their digital access. Is there anything else that you think that the other thing I was going to point out about government, of course, is that government, by definition, tends to be to react. To react to these things. And very often, and going back to what Noel said about data and understanding data, a lot of this goes over their head. I remember 5 years back, Wired had this beautiful data visualization of all the 311 calls in New York City and a map of it. And if you based your response on the map, large areas of Brooklyn large areas of Queens and the Bronx had no garbage problems.
Right.
And Manhattan had all the problems because people in Manhattan call. And these large areas in Queens and in Harlem, the Bronx, wouldn't call because most of them were immigrants. And in English was a second, if not a third language. And so how do we help both the communities and the leaders start thinking about this differently, knowing that it's moving very, very fast? And maybe, Nick, you can start off with that because you have government outreach. Or Noel, does Noel want to say something?
What's going on around participatory budgeting, where you're giving, it's intentional inclusion around civic services, and it's about figuring out where does that money go to, whether it's for basic infrastructure or whether it's for education programs, but it's about intentional inclusion in the civic sphere of decision making. And as part of that, it's making sure that, that government is listening to improve those different services and giving people an opportunity to engage. I guess a very simple way would be making sure that your 311 systems or your non-emergency complaint infrastructure is mobile friendly and that it has multiple platforms that enable people to engage within government so that way you don't have those deficiencies and the data doesn't express a particular bias that you're intentionally including individuals.
It wasn't that like 311 was not available in these neighborhoods.
Sure, but I can give you another example after playing around with 311 data for quite a while. Is looking at the south side of Williamsburg, which is a historically Hasidic neighborhood. There are very little noise complaints. And so, you know, over time, you look at the neighborhood and you're like, wow, it's not a very noisy neighborhood. What's going on in that neighborhood? Why is that? And that's, I mean, it's a very family-friendly residential neighborhood. So it's not going to have a lot of noise complaints. There are not a lot of bars and restaurants in that area. Right. But those are all unique biases within the data that are always expressed within different elements of the data. Mm-hmm. And at least in when we're talking about data as part of the digital divide conversation, it's a point of conversation where you need to have more people discussing what's going on within that data because there's going to be a lot of different opinions or expressions within that data. And the same thing goes for, I mean, this whole broader conversation around technology.
Right. So more participation.
Fundamentally, also, it's about building systems that enable people the mass amounts of participation, right? You cannot have the few building the stuff for the many. In my world within civic technology, it's build with, not for. It's about intentional inclusion to right. solve all of the social problems that we have.
I don't know if anyone has actually cracked that nut.
Well, I mean...
And I'm coming from a foundation that has funded heavily in civic technology. And what we realized was we were making it easier for people who are already connected.
And this is where intentional inclusion is a fundamental value. Okay. That you have to look at every single element and how do you bring in the uneducated, unwashed masses into your very technical conversation on solving the problems for the future. Because many people will have many different opinions, and you need to be exposed to understanding what those issues are. I hate to be so, you know, hippie about it, but, I mean, that's...
Eagle Scout. Maya, did you...
I think Noelle's making so many really important points that I think I want to lift up, but I want to lift it up in the context of saying where some of this has happened effectively, because I think we also talk about it as it's not on the app side, but it's on the civic engagement. If the platform... So as a non-technologist, I would say that the thing that I... Where we see it being effective is where there is an indigenous... community engagement on what the content is, not what the vehicle is for the content, right? So when it's focused around what people want to do, so in the context of Red Hook Initiative, it became about people's ability to communicate with one another, right? And to have a community bulletin board. So then talking about a mesh network and the ability to have that community bulletin board is a different conversation. Mm-hmm. And then when it's also about how the community participates in building it, right? So I know that's a little bit different from an apps-driven lens, but then it gives you the opportunity where you have that kind of community-based institution, community building, to actually be talking about the technology very, very differently because the end is the issue. Not how you get to the right. to the end, because the civic engage the technology does not replace the civic engagement, and I think that's what we all have to remember, right? It's the having civic engagement that then can utilize technology mm-hmm. is really the primary mm-hmm. the primary mm-hmm. issue.
Nick, did you want to?
I have two ideas that build on that, but one is that I think a lot of the focus on civic technology and the world that you were in and the world that I came from has been about building new technology that has an explicit civic purpose, above the sort of broadband and access issues, but like deliberative stuff and engagement stuff. And an idea that has really stuck with me for the last few years is that an alternative approach, not necessarily, another approach would be to make existing apps more civic, right? So you've got reach and you've got distribution. People are already on Facebook, they're already on Twitter, they're already using the apps that they have. And I think if we're thinking about how do cities think about technology to reach people and to solve problems in new ways, it's a shift in mindset is going to, I think, have to happen from we build it all to let's see what's there and what can we tap into. So if people in the Bronx aren't using 3-on-1, what are they using? Are they on WhatsApp? Are they on Snapchat? Like, how can we figure out how to build a tentacle into that that can reach people where they are? And doing that requires a different view of your role as a facilitator and an understanding of the landscape and frankly, and partnerships with private companies who have that distribution. So I think that's a big part of it too. And then the other idea that, and this is maybe a little bit beyond the topic of today's conversation, is I think there's another digital divide that's happening, which is between the tech platforms that are building all kinds of new infrastructure for cities, whether that's the Ubers and Lyfts of the world, and plenty of others, not limited to those, education platforms, health platforms, you name it, the folks in the public sector side, whether they're in a regulatory position or an executive position, and that there's a very different approach to looking at data and making sense of data and making policy decisions based on data. And a lot of the loggerheads and tensions and fights that we're seeing play around in this have to do with a different, you know, perspective and a different worldview and a set of skills around how to use all that data to make decisions and make policy decisions. So that's a different kind of a digital divide, but I think it's an equally important one that gets to, I think, a lot of the work that Noel is doing with education on how do you make use of data, how do you teach people how to make use of data, and so on.
I'm going to take that and ask one last question with Mandu, and then we'll open it up as a Q&A. The prescriptions you had were that there should be a dedicated unit or agency looking at the broadband divide, and the second one was more cooperation across the region. Was that it?
Yes. So that really relates to capacity. And I have to say that in that respect, we're thinking mostly about broadband deployment and effective broadband deployment, whoever actually does the deployment, whether it's the private sector or the public sector, or some collaboration. But just to speak to the point everyone just made, you know, one of the things we've noticed, you know, we tend to think about poverty in the New York region as an urban thing, as maybe a New York City thing, but in fact, we've seen poverty sort of increase actually more outside of, in sort of areas that I think about as typically suburban and affluent. And when you combine that with the digital divide that Nick just talked about, the digital divide between governments, you know, some governments who have, or at least part of the government, you know, New York City clearly is a national and international leader in sort of like trying to think about the impacts of technology. It's a huge task, but it's still, you know, leading ahead above to municipalities that don't even have a website or can't even post the meeting of the next city council. I mean, we were just talking about that. There's just some really huge gaps. So layer that with sort of like equality, and that is indeed another layer of the divide. And the other thing I wanted to mention, you know, there were a lot of transportation planners here in the room. So if we're thinking about what would this, you know, actually making this community-driven, community-owned, community design, what would an on-demand system of transit look like if it's community-driven instead of sort of designed top-down? What would the infrastructure look like? And then, you know, for example, you know, is the physical infrastructure that exists now, the physical broadband that exists now, a barrier to the system? I think those are the issues we need to consider really carefully when you're thinking 25 years out. And maybe that's sort of, those are the questions we'll at least start leading us towards solutions.
All right. We'll open up to questions. Are there people with mics that have them? There you go. Raise your hand. And let me just clarify, we're looking for questions. And you know it's a question if it ends with a question mark and your voice goes up. If you're going to make a statement, you can say that and we'll put you towards later. But we're looking for questions now. Tell us who you are and where you're from and then ask your question. We'll take this one, this gentleman. And then, okay.
Hello, I'm Britt Harder from PwC. I'm curious, what's the right scale of intervention? Is it the neighborhood? Is it the city? Or is it the region? And in a lot of... You know, can New York help Bridgeport, or can they only teach them by example?
Right. Brett, hold on to that mic. It's your job to point who's going to ask the next question. Okay?
Peer-to-peer.
So here's a quick question. What's the right scale of intervention here? Are we going to do like the first plan had of let's build highways across this region? And let's build broadband across the region. Maybe we already actually have that, but they're all owned by... What's the right scale? I was going to say community. I'm going to say that.
Yeah, of course. and I think that if you look at the interventions that are already happening from the ground up, whether it's in Spain or in Greece or here in the United States through the Occupy movement, it is at a neighborhood. Ultimately, it becomes at a neighborhood basis. You want to solve the problems that you and your neighbors are having because that's where you live, and those are the problems that you experience the most. And then, you know, for those of us who are lucky to have many neighborhoods that we can call home, we're fortunate enough to bounce from those different neighborhoods and see a much broader set of problems. But ultimately, you know, for my neighbors, it's not about what's happening in other parts of Brooklyn. It's what's happening in Greenpoint and kind of like how the massive income inequality that's kind of changing our rent. So I see it very much at the neighborhood level, which ultimately builds those stronger, healthier communities, resilient communities during times of crisis, whether they're environmental or they're economic.
So I think it's all three. I think the idea of mutual exclusivity is actually something that can tamp down on finding the right opportunities and intervening where they exist. Because I think this is such a massive undertaking. There's no one single leap, which means we have to pull every lever, you know, and we have to walk through every door. So in our instance, it is I don't know what the regional play is. I admit that. I have no clue. But certainly we've done both, citywide and local and neighborhood-based. And it's because we had opportunity to do citywide and we had some opportunity to do local. If I knew what the opportunities were to do regional and we saw what those were, we would hop in them. I don't think there's any question about that. In the short run, I would say from a government perspective, the reality is that you have to do some experimentation at home before you can work well outside of home.
Brett, you get to name who? Look in front of you, look behind. All right. He chooses another guy.
Hey,
I was hoping it'd be more democratic. That's okay. I'm just kidding. Go ahead.
Jay with Transit Screen. One quick question and then another follow-up. For the folks up on stage, how many have actually used Link NYC? Yeah, okay.
I refuse to.
Same. Okay. There's a lot of barriers to that.
Privacy issues.
Email, really? Downloading an app to your phone,
sure.
So aside from kind of just the pure cash play and giving unparalleled access to the Coca-Colas of the world of the street furniture, what kind of content can we expect to see on Link NYC? Because right now it's just ads. And not to pontificate, but we're really just, the free Wi-Fi is great, but if nobody's using it, I'd also be really curious to know what the usage statistics are.
Well,
because there are so many barriers to actually inputting your email, downloading something to your phone, and then having that buy-in.
Right. And by the way, you might want to say what Transit Screen does.
Sure. So we put real-time transit information. We put real-time transit information in public places and in lobbies on displays
to
provide valuable content.
And do you want to be NYC screens?
Maybe.
Okay.
So one thing just to remember is Link NYC just started rollout. So, I mean, to talk about utilization yet when it's literally, it's now more than 100 links, but they literally, the mayor just did a stand-up just like, 2 months ago, launching it from, and it's still in beta. So obviously one of the things that government does is track utilization, and we will have that data available, and you know, Noah won't be amongst that data set. That's okay. But I think obviously that's an important point. What we have been, the reason it's ads right now is one, it's still in beta, and two, in order to get the revenue, this is actually a business model where there is a long period of being in the red. So it actually is important from a business standpoint, and it's important to us as a city because we want them to exceed. We get 50% of their profits if their profits are higher than our guaranteed minimum income. So we're actually all in favor of it being very ad-driven right now so that they can get into the black and so that our revenue figures can go up. Because, again, that's what we'll use to invest. In terms of content, absolutely something we've been talking to them about is how we get to a variety of types of also public good advertising, not just for-profit advertising. So how the city can share information out, for example, is definitely something that's part of the conversation. It's just brand new, still rolling out, and, you know, obviously doing its proof of concept and its beta and starting to deliver on the revenue commitments it had made.
I think that's great. I mean, Lord knows, cities have allowed private sector to get both infrastructure and investment without getting anything back, sports stadiums. So this deal that seems to be we're actually getting money from it is good. Jake, who do you pick next? There you go.
My question sort of piggybacks off of that.
Tell us your name first.
Yep, my name is Jessica Lax. I'm from the Van Allen Institute. Okay. Are there other types of revenue models that have been considered outside of marketing to fund these kind of initiatives?
Particularly for Link NYC or just?
Just generally, in Link NYC as well.
Are you directing it to particular? Maybe Nick and...
I mean, I know one model that works for dark fiber is that the dark fiber provider gets a piece of the revenues from all the service providers that provide on top of it over time.
Basically, they rent.
They rent it out. So that works. I don't know too many details about the various nuances on the way to do that, but that's a tried and true model.
Pick your next question.
Yeah.
Oh, you don't have to run it well.
While you're doing that, I'll give you one more. The company I mentioned, Venium, that does free Wi-Fi over buses. The way they do that in they provide free Wi-Fi to the entire city of Porto, Portugal. And it's a sponsorship model, so not an ad model, but I think it's Vodafone has underwritten the whole thing, and they put their name on the side of the buses. So
but it doesn't pop up on your
But there's no ads or anything like that. It's just, on the buses.
Okay. Yes, ma'am.
I'm Juliet Michelson from RPA. I'm very intrigued by this dark fiber upfront investment that then gets lit up sort of over time. And I was wondering, of all of those cities that you showed earlier, the ones that have higher speeds at lower costs, in places that typically have a stronger, more empowered government with more resources maybe than our government does, is that what happened there? And, if the U.S. is a place where that isn't necessarily the government we have, what's the ROI on this? I mean, is there room for actually a private company to lay out the dark fiber and expect to get a payback period of fewer than, 5, 10
years?
I'll
pipe in, right? So in terms of return on investment, we don't know yet. There's a group of cities, gigabit cities is what I call them. I don't know what their formal name is. It's a bunch of notably second tier and third tier cities. Chattanooga is among them, who are trying to figure out how to roll out broadband in as many ways as they can, some of them with a private partnership, some like Chattanooga, that basically they had the fiber because they were running the utility,
right?
A power utility. And they decided that it was a shift in the services of the power utility, therefore they were going to charge for them. And they were actually, the state tried to shut that down, and the state is trying to keep them from expanding. But a whole bunch of other models. Google actually started buying up dark fiber in the late 90s, when they started, right? And there was already fiber that was being run by the old railroads and the power companies that were meant for a different use but weren't being used for communication. So some of that infrastructure is already there. I think the question, and I'm sorry that I'm answering, I'm probably moderating, the question goes back to the municipalities don't know how to think about it or how to even try it.
There are a handful of organizations, OTI, New American Foundation, OTI is one. There's a research firm called Diffraction Analysis. There's a handful of organizations that have done the research on all the models and all the cities and how it worked that are the ones who are well-positioned to answer that question, because each city is figuring it out on their own and has never done it before.
Can I just, to be the city in the room that actually does think about dark fiber, but the problem is that we're 330 square miles as a city with 8.5 million people, which is the size of the next three largest cities combined.
In the U.S.
But what that means is, so we are thinking about how we leverage, but it's not and this is a problem, this is honest talk. The problem, you can show a city a return on investment, doesn't matter. I mean, we know now, we could say, I don't even know what the number is, but there's absolute agreement that there's a return on investment. But if the investment's going to return is going to be realized in 20 years, it's just an impossible sell. Politically, I mean, and because, you know, then it's also, there's a limited pool of money. So unless the federal government, I mean, this is where policy matters a lot, and you can't take out the role of national government and assume that cities can solve this problem on their own. Because that could be solved if the federal government were able to actually say, we're going to spend significant amount of resources on public options. But traditionally, of course, it's federal policy being, we will underwrite private sector infrastructure, not public options, which then leaves cities that are already cash-strapped. So you find creative ways, and I will say one of the things that we've done is figured out in our franchise agreements, the new ones, not the ones that are 15 years old, which we didn't negotiate, how we can negotiate for municipal fiber to be included. But, you know, when you're 330 square miles, that's not going to be suddenly a citywide municipal network anytime soon.
I'm really excited to look at how Barcelona is going to be rolling out their reinvented smart cities initiative. So they've, with the new government that's in place in Barcelona, they're reevaluating all of their smart city contracts and their municipal Wi-Fi contracts and framing it around investing in the commons. And so instead of having, let me find a politically way sensitive or comfortable way to say this, instead of having a corporation kind of own all of the user data that some public Wi-Fi systems have, they want to figure out how it's going to be, how it will improve the commons and be owned by the commons in some public-private partnership that has yet to be determined. But they're moving away from the advertisement based revenue model to something that's more collective ownership.
All right, you get to pick who's next.
Another factoid is that I think something like 22 states have outlawed municipally owned
broadband. Yes.
Yes.
And they're doing it because the telecommunications firms are
Alec.
Yes. Not New York, New Jersey, or Connecticut.
No, but we've weighed in. I mean, this is important. We have actually weighed in as a city.
Yes.
On behalf of those cities in those states, because even though that's not our problem here, I think it is critically important for cities to align with one another around their ability to create this municipal options. And so we're in it with them.
Hi. My name is Oscar Abello. I'm a reporter with Next City. I'm sorry, I was in and out a little bit, so I might have missed this, but did anyone bring up Cleveland and One Community?
No, nope.
Okay.
Not.
So 13 years ago, Anchor Institutions and the Cleveland Foundation got together and they did the dark line thing. They built 13 years ago, 2,400 miles of fiber optic cable. They used 7 different sources of capital totaling $200 million. Over the course of these 13 years. And, you know, at first they're serving hospitals, universities, but, you know, soon the sports teams came calling, downtown law firms came calling, and soon the commercial end of the business got to be so big that they spun off a commercial entity that the nonprofit One Community remains a minority owner in that commercial entity to actually run the commercial broadband business in Cleveland. Now, one of the unique things about this is that no one else wanted to build it in Cleveland, so they were like, well, we're going to have to do this. So they did it. Not so much an option in New York City, but...
And I'm going to press you and say, the question is...
Mm-hmm. Well, it wasn't the question.
I did have a question.
My question was, did anyone talk about Cleveland and One Community? And the answer was no. So I.
Well, I do want to say one thing that I didn't already. One of the things that we've done as a city is, for the first time in the history of the city, we've created a capital budget line for broadband, and we have a $70 million budget. So that's in addition to any other revenue we can draw from, right? But never before in the history of the city has there been a budget line for a capital budget line for broadband.
You get to choose.
We have time for. Let's not have repeats yet.
I shouldn't be pointing. I said you get to choose. I'm pointing. Trying to change the power structure here, Noelle.
Wielding the veto.
You can go next, Britt. Hi, I'm Rebecca McGregor from PwC. And Ms. Wiley, you said something earlier that stuck with me. You said the infrastructure is not the end game. So I would like to ask all of you, what are your thoughts on the future of the application layer, especially government applications that provide access to public safety or public security information to enhance public good? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, what she said. That's it. So from my perspective, it's that we are actually a connected city, and by connected, I don't just mean the infrastructure. I mean we literally can talk to each other, interact, solve problems, get the services we need in the ways that we need them because we have not just the infrastructure; it's what we actually are able to do because of the infrastructure and how we do it together.
I'll answer that in a slightly different way, which is I'm not sure the civic app layer is the important layer. I think it's the API layer. So I think it's important for cities to be able to talk to companies and companies be able to talk from cities in a read-write fashion so that, a lot of the talk about sort of civic data so far has been what data can we get governments to open up, which is good. But there's also what service endpoints can we open up? How can private platforms like a Twitter or like a Lyft or like an Airbnb, anything, both communicate data back to the city about how the city's operating? Because we've got these real-time sensor networks. And you have to design partnerships to kind of make that kind of thing happen. And also, like we were talking about before, have the city be able to talk back out through those networks. And so I think this sort of city as connector, as API connector, and champion of standards, of open standards that connect all these interfaces, I think is a really important role.
Mm-hmm. And for the non-geek among us, API is?
Application programming interface, so a way for two applications to talk to each other using code instead of your thumbs.
And cities need to be smarter about how they develop technology. We're kind of at the end of one era, and Amazon Web Services was launched in 2006, 10 years ago. Cloud computing and kind of the notion of the cloud is only 10 years old. Just this administration, I commend the de Blasio administration for launching GitHub practices so that way code can be open and social and be shared, as well as putting some baseline of like how the cloud is incorporated into the city. We as an advocacy organization from Beta NYC are pushing more for that type of modern 21st century technology to be incorporated into government. It's now the next phase is really getting this administration to invest in in that framework. So that way technology can be improved so that way we can get APIs and then the customers can ultimately then leverage whatever network that's out there, including the Link NYC, to engage in that. And that right there is my biggest frustration is that it's trying to find the internal advocates within the city and give them the power to create that type of agency inside of the city that they can then take the time to decommission the mainframes that the city has or the really antiquated technology contracts that they have. So that way we can move into the 21st century and have ubiquitous technology for all of us. So.
We got time for, I think, one or two more questions and then we're going to wrap.
Sorry.
Wrap up.
One more guy in the back.
I like the mesh network Q&A. It's good.
I have a question, two questions.
Tell us your name first, sir.
Jeffrey Dunn, the incubator, tied into New Jersey, been a network of incubators throughout the state of New Jersey. Two questions. One, how are the libraries being used as a digital resource for free Wi-Fi, for education, for job search, okay, and just literally a hub of 21st century information. And again, like the library was for the 20th century, there needs to be an upgrade, a revolution, a evolution, a metamorphosis to bring our libraries into the 21st century. Part two, is there any conversation, any dialogue in reference to educating small business so that they can step their game up
in regards to the resources of, again, internet, because they're losing out. Many of them not realizing that 20-30% of their revenue should be cyber. Also, they're also missing out in reference to government procurement, because government procurement is now going paperless. And if they're not in government procurement, they lose out. So those two questions.
So the first one is New York City's library system for the last two administrations has done a really great job to figure out how to bridge the digital divide through, I believe, the New York City Public Library has a checkout program where you can check out Wi-Fi hotspots for students.
It's actually citywide. It's all three systems.
It's all three systems now?
It always was. It was just the New York Public organized it, but it's 10,000. But it's throughout the entire.
It's a phenomenal. Maybe I should have let Maya get to that. The second thing is like the Small Business Administration through the last administration and into this one is actually teaching small businesses how to get online, how to use Facebook, how to use Twitter, how to use Yelp, and SBS here in New York City. I mean, these are only the examples that I know. Has a really good education program to teach small businesses how to get online, so that way they're at least cyber aware. Now, whether a bodega is going to be able to sell an avocado through Amazon is a different story. But, I mean, it's at least the step, right? I commend this administration for a lot of the steps that they're doing to ensure to protect small businesses and get them digitally aware. There's a map that's around broadband, so that way small businesses know where they can move around that has internet access if they're a cyber business. Additionally, there's another map that focuses that comes out of Moda that talks about where a small business. Do you know the Moda map? This Small Business Atlas. The city's mayor's office of data analytics. Has created a map so that way if you're a small business, you can type in your address and it'll tell you all the economic factors that have happened in your neighborhood that you can then take to a bank and say, look, my neighborhood's changing. I want to grow my small business. Will you help me get a loan? It demonstrates all the economic incentive for that bank to essentially invest in a small business.
If I may just add, I want to say to you, I appreciate what you're saying, and that's really good stuff, but the main thing I was talking about, we have, again, over $20 billion worth of procurement that's on the horizon. 20 to 30% of it is supposed to go towards small business. They can't even begin the process unless they know SAM, System Automated Management. Yeah. And that's the education I'm talking about. So, but I'm not ignoring nor basically downplaying what you're saying. But I'm talking about the bigger picture because of this major economic engine, the number one public works project in the country, has to have a component as far as small business. And if they don't have that cyber component, then basically small business will lose.
So two points that I'll just add, because it's a very important point you're making, is the city's also investing in fiber in industrial zones that have not had it, and there are small businesses there, which can increase access. But also SBS, Small Business Services, has literally programs to hand walk small businesses in a business solution centers to help businesses identify how they actually improve their business, including that. So is there more we can do? Certainly. But I do think there are a number of good programs in place that are very helpful.
I'll add one slightly different comment. Maybe this sounds a little out of left field, but sometimes business on the internet looks totally different than it did before. It may not just be about wiring up everybody to do their same business, digitally. So we have an app called YouNow, which is a live video app. People go on and broadcast live all the time. One of the most popular guys on YouNow is a guy who's a cashier at a bodega in Queens. His name is Mr. Cashier. And for him, having a business on the internet is actually being a TV star, and he gets money getting tipped and stuff while he's sitting there working. And so I'm just saying sometimes it's way different than we think.
I think the other thing, too, is the kind of business intelligence that if you could pull together the data from all the small businesses.
Sure.
There's a small provider in Portland that does this, that shows you that your buyers, the people who buy ice cream in your shop usually come from the sewing store. So if you could tie in some sort of offer, that would be great.
Last year, the city record, which is the canonical database of city procurement activities in New York City, There was a piece of legislation that we advocated for that the mayor signed, thanks to the council, that essentially digitizes all of those procurement requests with an API, so that way you can actually programmatically access that information, or you can subscribe to it through emails and through other notifications, so that way you can actually find out, if you're a small business, you can find out how to do business. And the gentleman who just walked out is also from Gail Brewer's office, and they've been trying to work to get small businesses and WMB, which is also Scott Stringer's office, has been trying to fight for a lot of that. So there's a big effort.
All right. So I'm going to ask our panelists short phrase, quick word, or whatever, before we close. What do we need to change now so that we're heading in the right place? Mandy.
Me too. just really start with informed community groups and informed government, and I think it's about the work that Noel's doing.
That's it. Informed. I'm going to keep it short for you guys.
Collaboration and intentional inclusion. Find your others and find the non-others and work with them to think about solutions for all of us.
Okay. We need to partner, public sector, private sector.
Okay. Maya?
What they said.
So...
for the others and the non-others.
Thank you so much. So in 1996, when they last released the third regional plan, there was a small play that had started in an experimental theater and opened in Broadway. It was called Rent. And it had a song. And 25 years, stealing from it, is 13,140,000 minutes. So think about that. Thank you so much. Help me thank our panel. Thank you. Thank you so much.